Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget your machete as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about anomalies, legends, and monsters. I'm the one introducing this week's show. My name is Seth Breedlove. This is a new addition to the Monsteropolis roster of shows. During the pandemic currently wracking our country, we are going to record additional episodes of the show and post them to the feed for you guys to check out. Most of these are going to be interviews. And I think right now the plan is to post this particular interview show on Tuesdays, but there may be an additional show we'll also be adding, and that will be more sporadic. But this show will post on Tuesday mornings, and this week's episode, the first episode of these additional shows, is an interview with my buddy Shayana Steingass. And this is a really interesting episode. We're excited to dive into oceanic and lake monsters and things like that. So I think you guys will really dig this week's episode. Don't forget to leave us a rating and review on iTunes. Send mail to monsteropolismail@gmail.com so we can really dive into talking about listener mail. We want to do an entire listener mail episode. So monsteropolismail@gmail.com. Hope you guys enjoy the additional shows. Thanks for listening. Let's just really naturally start talking, like the door just started open.
That was almost really natural.
I'm probably going to begin the episode with that, actually. Tell us what you do, Shay.
I am a marine mammal behavioral ecologist, which means I study how marine mammals interact with their environment, the marine environment, to survive. I also do marine science communication as kind of a background activity. So I try to communicate science to non-scientific art audiences and do a number of K-12 events as well. So I completed my graduate degrees, my PhD and my master's degree studying harbor seals on the Pacific coast to understand where they're going, what they eat, and how their habitat drives those behaviors.
And that involves hats.
It does. Yeah. So I occasionally like to put hats on seals. So these little devices are used to track them as they move around their environment. You can also attach a number of instruments to them, including oxygen sensors, dive depth sensors, pretty much anything you want to, heart rate and accelerometers, to really get to see an animal in its environment that you otherwise wouldn't be able to do.
What does that do? Like, what is that data telling you? Like, 'cause you said that, and then you sent me like pictures of seals with hats on. And I was like, what purpose does it serve?
Well, first of all, it's adorable.
Yeah.
But marine mammals are really populous and really an important part of how the near shore ocean functions. So they are top predators. Mm-hmm. And so we can actually use them for sentinels of the ocean itself. So we can do health studies in marine mammals and understand microplastics and toxins in the ocean. But really to understand how animals in the ocean behave, we have to have alternate ways of observing them. So just like you would put a collar on an elk or a bear, this is the best way to track animals at sea. So a lot of those guys out there, a lot of the larger whales, seals and sea lions, we don't have very much data on what they actually do in the ocean. And that can inform things like shipping channels, entanglements, fisheries interactions, other things that happen when you have animals in their environment and then people on top of that.
So we know each other because I think the first time I met you was at CryptidCon.
Yeah. Jen and Lee's event in 2018.
Yeah. Why were you there? Because you just kept commenting to me that you're really skeptical of all this. And I was like, well, what are you doing here?
Did I? I don't know. I'm just kidding.
No, but what are you into this stuff? Like, what's your interest in like the cryptids and paranormal?
Yeah, well, I just love it. I am skeptical, but that doesn't mean you can't really enjoy it. I was that weird kid growing up in Wyoming that would just check the ghost books, the 5 ghost books out over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. For my birthday this year, I actually had my mom ship my entire Time Life Mysteries of the Unknown series to Oregon, so I have those now. But I've just really been into it. And in college, when I was studying pre-veterinary medicine, I was really, you use that same side of your brain over and over. And so I guess instead of taking a break and like enjoying life, instead what I did was I designed my own non-Western literature minor. So I really got into folklore and religious studies. And to me, all of this is a really cool combination of how we view the natural world and how that fits into the kind of zeitgeist and allegory of what society is doing right now. But I also just love spooky stories, and I think religion and everything else, I think we're all seeking an alternate explanation for like the visual universe. I just love it. I just think it's fun. And I happen to know Lee and Jen and wanted to go support them. So I don't know. I had a weekend. I just flew out there. I didn't know what to expect, but it was really fun.
Do your interests, obviously you're probably into like the water based cryptids, but I mean, like, do you have an interest in Bigfoot and that kind of stuff too?
Yeah. I think just on the same note that it's really fun for me. I always get frustrated at some point along the line. Cause, one thing that I am seeing a lot of is trying to use science to, it's trying to hammer in a screw with a hammer. It's like you can do it, but it's not the right tool, and it doesn't really do justice to like the screw or the hammer, I guess. Because the main thing about science, and this is different than philosophy. I think you can use philosophy to explain this kind of stuff, but science is really based on repeatability. That's the whole premise. So if you can't control for things and apply treatments and have a repeatable outcome, then science is the wrong tool to be using. But that being said, I don't know, I like just going out in the woods. So sure, if you can come up with something to look for while you're out there, I think that's great.
Yeah. Well, like what is your favorite cryptid then?
Oh my God. That's a hard one.
Mark Matsky. It's the elusive Mark Matsky cryptid.
Yeah. I think that was, that's a close second.
Yeah. You'll never find me.
Yeah. Well, the one that kills me are the blobsters, because every time I look at those, I'm like, well, that's a dead whale. Those are like those ambiguous things that wash up on beaches.
Okay, yeah.
The one I really like, and I can never pronounce it, is the Monongal. That's a...
You're stumping me.
Yeah, it's a Southeast Asian cryptid. It's a female, and she detaches her torso from her lower body at night and flies around. And you can kill her by sprinkling salt on the torso that's left behind. Yeah, it's really dark and bizarre, but I love it because it's so unique. So,
are you aware of this, Mark? Because you're super into the Asian cryptids.
Yeah, no, this is very new to me. It's interesting.
Okay, so as long as we're talking, what's your take on like the Montauk Project? Does that fall within that Blobsters? Because like the Montauk Project has that, there's that picture of that creature that supposedly washed up on the...
The Montauk Monster?
Yeah, the Montauk Monster.
That's like 100% a dead raccoon, 100% for sure.
Dead raccoon?
Yeah.
So you think it's just like a scale thing? Because it looks a lot bigger.
Oh, it could be. I mean, when I look at it, I'm like, that's a dead raccoon. I don't know. I'll have to look at the scale, but...
Okay.
But okay. What I will say, so I've spent a lot of time around dead whales, and there's some weird stuff that happens when they decompose. And so I have some really good photos of it, but one of the weirdest thing that happens is the collagen, like in their bodies, the connective tissue breaks down, and it does start to look like hair.
Huh.
And so when you find these things on the beach and they're like, well, it can't be a whale because it has hair everywhere. It's actually collagen fibers.
How long does it take a whale to get to the point where it looks like hair, like it has
you
hair?
You know, a few days.
Really?
Yeah. So I went and took a blue whale apart in November 2017, and you saw some of that starting to happen. So I was there in the first couple of days. So it drifted around the ocean for a few days and then landed on the beach. And I was there in the first 2 days we were taking it apart, and you started to see some of that weird stuff happen, where it just turns into this jelly, gelatinous, nasty mess. And stuff just starts looking like it wasn't originally. So if you don't know how that process works, then it's pretty bizarre.
So do you just sort of, any of the Blobsters, do you kind of write them all into that category then? It's all like decomposing whales. You don't, there's a picture of like what they claimed was sort of a plesiosaur or some sort of plesiosaur, yeah, type creature being pulled up out of, it's like a famous photo of like,
you're
a
right,
decomposing. Is that just a whale? Isn't that a thing? Isn't it?
I think that's a basking shark.
Okay.
Because they have cartilaginous skeletons. Mm-hmm. And so they don't have the typical kind of an anatomical makeup you would see from like a whale or something. So when you, there, that's been broken down a lot, and that's my verdict on it. I guess I'm not that mean where it's like every time anything washes up, I'm like, well, that's just a dead whale. But having spent just a lot of time doing comparative anatomy and such of mammals in particular, it's just like anything, your brain gets a search image. And you know, once you see that skull anatomy, or once you see, you know, enough things decomposing on the beach, you realize like what things probably are. That being said, like it'd be super awesome if like something totally weird washed up from the deep ocean that we haven't seen, and that's completely possible.
Yeah, I mean, have you seen anything you couldn't? I mean, you've spent a lot of time out on the ocean. And working around like dead animals. I mean, have you seen anything you couldn't explain or you thought might be pointing to something cryptid or?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's a better intro for me, is like, I spend a lot of time in the ocean and around dead animals. So
yeah. That's probably, I'm going to rewrite your intro and be like, this is Shay. She spent a lot of time around dead animals and far too much time alone on the ocean.
It's true. I think that's real fair. So I'm trying to think, you know, there's a couple instances. I mean, I've seen some pretty amazing stuff on the ocean too, like bioluminescence. We were out on a cruise we were off the shore of California, and it was a new moon. So there was no moon, totally clear sky. And it was a huge bioluminescent event. And so every time the waves would cap, there would be this like blue, green, neon glow. So we actually turned all the running lights off the boat, and it was really cool because you lost all directional sense of where you are. And it was like the sea matched up with the sky. It was, wow. It was really, the two things that I can think of that were odd. Well, one is actually, we were down at an uninhabited island down by Baja, watching elephant seals playing in the surf line. And what I have photos and videos of this, but what blew my mind was how much they looked like mermaids down there. Like, I can totally see if from a distance you would be like, that's a mermaid. So I totally get that. The only, you know, if you talk to enough scientists who spend time at sea, we all see weird stuff. Mm-hmm. But for me, that's mainly been like atmospheric phenomenon. So sometimes you'll see what looks like a giant disc, like in the sky, where it's, I don't know if it's a temperature inversion or what, but it looks like there's a giant contact lens over you. Hmm. And then
are you sure that's not just like you're seeing the dome that's covering the flat Earth? Are you?
That could be it. That you're right. That totally could. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. We forgive you.
Yeah. Okay. I'll file that one away. The other weird thing was we saw, it wasn't a lightning storm or anything, and I still don't really know what explains this, but we were all on deck, and it looked like somebody had a giant mirror in the clouds that they were periodically flashing around. Enormous. It was. I have a video of that too on my old computer. But you see lots of weird stuff at sea. I don't, you know. And couple that with like being on a whaling boat for 200 days, covered in whale oil and smoke, and like you probably start your brain. I mean, we're about to all start seeing some crazy stuff if we stay home a little more.
Yeah, I already am. I have a 3-year-old, and I'm seeing all kind of crazy. Have you ever seen the movie The Beach, starring Leonardo DiCaprio?
I'm ashamed to say. Oh wait, was that like a horror thriller?
It was kind of a thriller. I don't know. I mean, it's got some creepy elements. It's not Shutter Island.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. Yeah. I'll have to rewatch it.
All right. Well, The Beach has a scene where Leo and some lady go swimming, and there's a lot of like bioluminescent stuff going on in the water, and there's a really great Sugar Ray song that plays during that scene, and I just wanted to tell you guys about it.
Yeah, thank you.
Mark, do you want to hop in with a question here before I go on to talking about Megalodon, which is what I want to get to next?
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, what's your take on, you know, creatures like Champ that are, you know, allegedly freshwater creatures versus saltwater? Is there any distinctions there, or what are your thoughts? Yeah.
Well, I think you have to break that down to the individual case. And I just want to be clear too. It's like, I'm a weirdo nerd that loves this kind of stuff. And so it doesn't make me very happy to just like outright dismiss everything without really thinking about it. Like, that's not what I like to do. I also don't think that does much for communicating these things and like breaking down the lines between people. You know, I think just being a jerk about everything and saying everything's fake and you're done doesn't really, that's not great science communication.
Sure. Right.
But you know, it's interesting with those, it's hard to tell where they stop and end, because we have here on the Oregon coast, a huge, figure, like a plaster fiberglass thing of what's supposedly the, you know, Yaquina Bay monster. That's just like, nobody's ever reported it. It's just like they came up with it.
I don't know. Can you elaborate on that? What is it?
It looks like a plesiosaur, but it's this like fiberglass painted molded. I mean, I can send you a photo. It's just like the infamous Yaquina Bay monster. And it's like, well, no, I mean, there's just somebody made it. Yeah, I don't know. It's really interesting to read those sightings. But it gets hard to break down to in terms of how the press was back in the day, which I guess isn't much different than today, where it's like there's really no accountability for just like if you have a blank square, just put a story in there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We definitely don't see that now. But what is interesting, though, is that there are populations, there are marine mammals that are freshwater. So Lake Iliamna in Alaska is said to have sea monsters in it, but there's actually a completely freshwater population of seals there. Same with Lake Baikal, and that's one of those where, what were those called, the Lake Baikal cryptids?
You've got so many obscure like cryptids in your vocabulary that I've never heard of.
In my brain, it's really terrifying how much is in there. But there's actually an entire species of freshwater seals there that are called Baikal seals. So it's interesting, in some of those cases, they overlap with places that there could be a marine mammal that people maybe didn't expect to see one there. So I don't know. I think it's a case by case thing.
Well, do you think there's anything to it? Like, do you think there's anything to say? Okay, just pull Champ out, because let's talk about Champ. Do you think there's anything to Champ? How much, I don't know how much reading or anything you've done on Champ, but do you think there's any possibility that there could be a real Champ? And if so, what is your best guess as to what it might be?
Yeah, well, I'll just say, like, I think the plesiosaur thing, we could probably throw that right out the window.
Aw, come on.
I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So I would sad. Love it to. It'd make me so happy if we had a plesiosaur or swimming around like Loch Ness. But what we do have, and that isn't very well described, are some larger species of freshwater eels that are really hard to detect on LIDAR. You don't see them very often, and they can get pretty long. You know, they're these dark animals that, you know, they can be 10 feet long or so. And I think there are animals that aren't really described or well seen that can be spotted, but I don't think it's like a plesiosaur, unfortunately. Can I jump in there? There's one other thing, and it's a little sensitive, but there's this author that keeps putting out publications talking about how early sea monster sightings were likely the first documentations of fisheries interactions and entanglements. But when you break down his sightings, I actually think a lot of what he's describing are whales mating. I guess let me get a little bashful here. But yeah, so I think like, specific anatomical parts of a whale can very much look like a sea serpent head when it's above the water. And I legit think that...
I'm so excited that we're talking about this on the show.
I know. So anyway, I think that's a thing.
That's super interesting, though. Yeah, like, I mean, obviously, you're not going to have, like, a blanket opinion of everything, but, like, what do you write off a lot of those early, what do you ascribe a lot of the very early, like, seafaring, sea monster sightings to? Is that, like, you don't think that, I want there to be sea monsters. To me, I've always loved that this part of history, where you've got sort of the explorers going out across the ocean and they're encountering all sorts of monsters, you know, right at the edge of the earth, right before the earth falls off. What do you think the percentage of our audience is that believes that I now am a 100% flat earther? Is it anyone?
I don't know. I'm like 100%.
Okay. So. I'm getting there. What do you think of a lot of that?
Yeah. Well, I think it's contextual. I think there's different categories. So, I think one of the main things to think about too is we picture these like seasoned seafarer sea captains, you know, Ahab out there, and they've seen everything, and then they see this one thing and they can't describe it. But I think a lot of people who are out on boats were a bunch of dudes who were in their 20s and they just took this job and they were probably miserable the whole time. Mm-hmm. And they didn't see, they had not seen a lot of this. And so you just dump them on a boat and they're going to see a lot of weird stuff and go home with that idea. Cause what else are you doing? I mean, you might have some whiskey or something on board and play cards, but you got to have something to talk about.
Right.
So I think there's some really compelling sightings. I mean, when I hear about one, I'll read through the whole thing and I'll say some of them, I don't know, which is the worst thing a scientist can say, I don't know, because then that's when everything gets filled in, depending on who interprets it. But there's some ones that I don't know. I don't know how to explain that. There's other ones that were probably things like sperm whales and giant squid and super cool stuff like that. And then there's others that are, you know, when I read them and you're kind of like, well, I have a rough idea of what this probably is, but it differs.
Mark and I have never done this on a show, but I've talked about wanting to get into the bloop. And I think I've mentioned before, this is like one of my favorite weird science stories. And it sounds like you have a direct connection to the bloop. So I need to, I need you, first of all, to set up what the bloop is for listeners, because this is another thing I've noticed lately. I think the story is getting so far in the past that people are kind of like, they forget what the bloop was. So can you set up like what the bloop was?
Yeah. So the bloop was an ultra, like a low frequency, extremely loud sound that was recorded by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, their acoustic lab, back in like 1997. So let me preface that with I was 11, living in Wyoming. Mm-hmm. So it was this super loud sound, very strange. And back in the day, as kind of an early fun example of science communication, they recorded it and were like, well, that's kind of cool. Let's throw it on the website. So they probably put it up on like their GeoCities or whatever. What did we have back then? I don't even know.
97 wasn't that long. Come on. 97? Yeah, it was probably GeoCities. Or they had it on like their MySpace, the National Oceanic MySpace page.
Yeah, so they threw it up, and then people just freaked out. I don't know what else to say. People flipped their lids, we can talk more, I guess, a little bit about that, the kind of fun part of that story.
The idea was like there were so many rumors about. So this is kind of what I want to ask you about, because there were so many rumors or stories that made the claim that like someone had analyzed the sound and they were able to discover that whatever this thing was so big that it could like devour like a blue whale or like, am I right? Right. Like, isn't that a thing? Like that?
Yeah. Like it was pretty much Cthulhu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Calling out or waking and like calling out to the world and whatever. But, whatever analysis came out said it was probably three times the size of a blue whale, animal three times the size of a blue whale, which, just for your reference, the blue whale is the largest animal that has ever lived on Earth, so ever. It was recorded at a like distance of 3,000 miles, so naturally people were like, wow, this thing has to be big. But when you look at the other, flip that on its head, it could have been something, and likely was, like ice shelves calving or something extremely large that wasn't biological. And so in the ocean where they deploy the microphones, it's called the sound fixing and ranging layer. It's this area of the ocean where sound can travel essentially across an entire ocean basin. So the fact that it was heard 3,000 miles away doesn't mean it was really any louder than any other sound. It's just that it was recorded in that perfect audio acoustic layer, if that makes sense.
That is so disappointing. So you don't think it was Cthulhu, is what your scientific analysis would lead you?
I mean, that would be pretty great.
Okay.
Yeah, it was either an animal three times the size, at least, of any known animal we ever have had on the planet, or it was something non-biological. But I think the fun part of that story is like when you start breaking it down to the poor people who recorded this, they essentially, and so I was able to interview them for my book that I'm hoping to get done at some point in my life. I don't know. And I had their permission to do it for that. So, but this is kind of off the cuff here. So I'll keep it broad, but if you want to know more, you can read my book when it comes out in 2047. So get ready for that. Get excited. Wow. So they got so many calls on this when they put it out there that they had a meeting, and they essentially, it was distracting from everything they were actually trying to do work-wise. And they said, let's just pull the website down. And I will say, if it probably was something that groundbreaking and like, oh my God, we discovered a new species, they probably wouldn't have just like thrown it up on the internet. Anyway, so they pulled it down. But then what happened is then it became a bigger conspiracy, right? Because all of a sudden the sound is gone. Mm-hmm. And then people just proceeded to lose it even more. And so the folks that recorded that sound I mean, how long ago was 1997?
This is 2020.
23 years ago, yeah. They still get calls on it today, like when they're just going about their normal business, you know. And
I mentioned that book to you once, that comic book by Scott Snyder, The Wake.
Right.
Did you ever read it by any chance? You need to read it.
I'll read it.
It's really cool. But that book even makes references to the Bloop, and it's, you know, it's a DC comic, like it's a big book. Yeah, so like I think that thing has kind of become a part of pop culture in a way. Like I think it might have been referenced on X-Files.
Well, and the funny thing too is when that Mermaids documentary, The Body Found or whatever the heck that was in like 2013, I think either the original or the sequel used the Bloop, and I, you know, it was like the next day in the office, it was like, oh my God, it's like won't go away. Yeah. So it's just kind of funny. It's kind of a continual comedy to watch people have to deal with that, I guess.
Mark, do you want to hop in?
Sure. The giant squid, you know, how much have you looked into that? Because that's generally brought out as, you know, proof of cryptozoology in a sense, that people said there was a kraken or giant squid, but nobody knew for sure until some of those camera captures revealed a much larger squid than people really thought was there. So have you looked into any of that or had any comment on the giant squid in itself?
Have you seen one?
Not like, I saw the one at the Smithsonian and like that blew my mind when I was a kid. You know, because like growing up in Wyoming, wanting to do marine science, everyone was like, what's wrong with you? So seeing stuff, getting to see stuff like that just really made a mark on me. But yeah, they're so cool and they're super terrifying. Yeah, there's the giant squid and the colossal squid. And I really do think, you know, people, if you were to see that, I mean, you would freak out, you know, in the ocean. And being that sperm whales pretty much exclusively feed on squid, and they have been found with actual injuries from the giant squid as well.
Oh, wow.
It's totally possible that people have seen that out there.
Do you think there's an actual kraken? Like that could be even big. I mean, the giant squid, the colossal squid's cool, but like, is there an even bigger squid that's like informed the kraken mythology, or is that just like misidentifying the bigger squids? Basically, I want to know if because I love the kraken, I would like to know that there's a real kraken, and I need you to tell me there is.
Okay. I hope so. I hope there is. How's that?
All right, that's fine.
Yeah, and I mean, like legit, like I don't think we really have any like modern evidence or sightings of something even bigger. We know so little about the giant and colossal squid to begin with that, for all we know, it could be a bunch of different species, and we, you know. But because they're so deep down, you know, the other thing about, you know, animals in the ocean, deep sea creatures in the kind of cryptozoology conversation on that is animals that are deep down usually don't travel up in the ocean very often because they'll essentially just dissolve, you know. And so a lot of times when scientists go and pull animals from deep ocean trenches, they do so in that they bring them encapsulated back up in a high pressure environment, because otherwise it's pretty terrible. Like they just, it'd be like throwing a human out into space, you know?
Wow. Yeah.
Jeez. And so we're still learning about that. And I think, you know, I think we're going to get a better idea of deep sea diversity, or unexplored environments with this whole eDNA thing. Because we're able to essentially take a sample of seawater from anywhere and find out what species are there and what species are there that we don't necessarily have like a DNA primer for, meaning they're not identified beyond like a certain grouping.
Wow.
Yeah.
More, Mark? I was asking if Mark had more on that.
No, the squid was really my big thing.
That was your big one.
That was my big one.
So I don't want to leave out mermaids entirely. So can we talk about mer-beings and where? So what I've never really, no pun intended, but I've never really dove into that topic before. I've never dived? Dove?
Dove in.
I've never dove into that topic before. So like what I understand that's like one of the oldest mythologies, right? Or oldest legends or whatever you want to call it. And that like it has more recently become sort of a subtopic of cryptozoology. But how far back do those stories go? And what have you found in looking in?
Yeah. Well, first off, I have a little joke for you I thought of today. So what do you call it when a mermaid stays at home?
I don't know.
Very topical. Shellfish in place.
Oh, wow. I'm sorry, listeners.
Breaking outside. That's a really, and that again is, so I guess a little context on this book proposal. Like, I'm not one of those people that's like, yeah, I'm writing a book. It's going to be pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. And you won't see it. But I almost had an agent for this thing. And then they decided it was too narrow, and so I'm shopping it around. So hopefully it will happen. But part of that book is talking about the history of mermaids. So the book in itself, like me, a biologist looking at mermaids, looking at the history of seafaring, and then also the folklore and kind of fun history with that. So the original mer-being was really, I mean, it really originated in Mesopotamia. So as far back as we have written history, there is a mermaid or context for a mermaid type of creature. So one of those is, and I never know if I'm pronouncing it, but it's Mesopotamia, so probably not. Atargatis, which was an extremely powerful mermaid type god. And what's really interesting is a lot of those mermaid early prototypes all represented abundance and fertility. So it was a running theme. They were all extremely powerful, and they all kind of belied our connection to the sea. And so if you ask me, in a way, like, no matter how you look at mermaids, they're this really amazing personification of like our ties to the sea, but also kind of a feeling of they encapsulate the fact that no matter how much we want to be part of the ocean, we can't. So they're both, they represent us, and they also represent the other at the same time.
What are descriptions of mer beings though? Because this was something I found was like, it's not necessarily the Disney sort of like princess view of what a mer-being.
No, and they originally there's usually a two-tailed kind of a being. They ranged in size, and like I said, they ranged from like super god to demigod to goddess kind of a creature. But they originally weren't like sexy. They were sometimes grotesque, dangerous, macabre style of creatures, and that's my favorite kind of mermaid, like personally. And it's interesting because they take a turn too. At some point in Greek mythology, you know, they turn into the harpy, they turn into the sirens, and they, again, they weren't really attractive beings. The harpies were half bird, half women with these, like, I mean, essentially breasts. They were weird, and they were terrible. But, you know, I think when you look at mermaids too, as a biologist, I have some pretty specific opinions as to what a mermaid would actually, a biologically feasible mermaid would look like. And it is not aerial at all.
So what is it?
Well, so there's an article I wrote back in the day on this, called Fishful Thinking, on Deep Sea News. And I had actually wrote that article. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing. Like I was spending a week down in California doing whale tagging, and my colleagues and I have gotten so tired of people asking us about the mermaid documentary, meaning the fake one that Discovery put out, that I just jotted up this article in about an hour of like, okay, this is why mermaids aren't real. You know, it was kind of funny. But there's a lot of things that, for example, marine mammals or marine animals have that mermaids in no way can have. For example, if it was a mammal-type being, we would expect the mermaid, first of all, the whole arms thing wouldn't work because you have to maintain so much body heat and so much metabolic energy as a marine mammal, which is why if you look at whales and you know, seals and stuff, they have short little flippers in comparison to their bodies. So you essentially would have an animal where its arms would just freeze off. They would be obese, you know, by our standards, because they'd have to have, they would either adopt the strategy of being obese, or they would adopt the sea otter strategy of having, just being completely covered in thick hair. So right there, that kind of ruins it.
All right. So final question, if you had, limitless funds and could go in search of any of the beings, the cryptids, whatever that you like, which would it be?
God, that's a fun question. I think it would probably be following up on all of those. Okay. I mean, for one, and I'd have to say this is one of my favorite cryptids, is the Mokele Mbembe, the little dinosaur. God, I love it so much. So there's that. But I would say, like, any of the lake sea monsters, and even just scientifically, I would love to just do eDNA for, like, every major body of water in the world and just see what is in there. Because especially lakes, it's so hard to really figure out at all what's swimming around. And I think we'd find some pretty cool stuff.
That's a good one. All right. Shay, thanks for joining us. We're gonna shut down the show, but we will be doing these new interview shows every week until COVID-19 goes away, and then I'll probably keep doing it after that, because we're gonna get, and so it's fun. So okay, I'm closing down this week's show. We're back next week. Peace.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com, and is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.